Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to season 9 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is episode 9-12, Aurangzeb's Jizya. Before we begin, I'm going to read a verse from the Quran regarding the jizya. This is from chapter 9, verse number 29. So this would be Surah Tawbah. Just do the English, won't do the Arabic right now. Allah says, what translates to, fight those who do not believe in Allah in the last day, nor comply with what Allah and His Messenger have forbidden, nor embrace the religion of truth from among those who were given the scripture until they pay the tax, willingly submitting, fully humbled. Okay, so this is a verse that legislates the jizya in Islam. There's more to it, but this is the beginning of it all. Now, I am not qualified to discuss the legal aspects of the jizya from a Sharia point of view, from the view of Islamic law. I am not a scholar or a faqih, but I can discuss the reality of the jizya and the history of the jizya, and that's what we're going to try to do today. The question is, does the emir have the right to waive the jizya? Now, by the time we finish this episode, I will not have answered that question, but I want you to think about this because this relates to whether Akbar had the right to abolish the jizya. And not just Akbar, but also his successors, that is Jahangir and Shah Jahan, did they have the right to abandon and abolish the jizya? Allah knows best, but we're going to talk about the jizya during the reign of Aurangzeb, why he did it, how it made the Hindus living in the Mughal Empire feel, and what were the results of his decision to impose the jizya in 1679. As we mentioned in the previous episode, Aurangzeb became the emperor of the Mughal Empire in 1658, but he did not impose the jizya until 1679. Most historians mark this incident, this event, the imposition of the jizya, as the turning point in the Mughal Empire, and they believe that this began hastened the empire's disintegration. And as I mentioned in the previous episode, Aurangzeb is often accused of bigotry, and that I hope by the time we finish this episode, you will see that that is not necessarily true. But also he's accused of alienating the Hindus, and that might be true. Perhaps whether he intended to do that or not, it is very likely that him bringing in the jizya or bringing back the jizya because it existed before him, it is very likely that bringing the jizya back to the Mughal Empire did alienate the Hindus, but whether he did it out of some sort of anti-Hindu bias, I hope, inshallah, we get to answer that question by the time this episode is over. Many of these same historians say that the jizya led to increased Hindu opposition against the Mughal Empire, but not only did it push the Hindus to oppose the Mughals more fervently and more frequently and more violently, but also pushed Aurangzeb and the Mughal Empire to become more of a Muslim-focused state, a state that was predominantly by and for Muslims, thereby alienating the Hindus. I am not necessarily saying that is true, but many historians do push that narrative. And again, I do agree that the jizya did lead to the alienation of many Hindus, but the question is whether this was done because Aurangzeb disliked Hindus or had some sort of bias against Hindus. That we will see, hopefully, before the end of this episode. Now, when it comes to the Mughals, we have to appreciate the fact that the Mughals were a minority ruling class. It was a Muslim minority ruling over a Hindu majority. The sultans, the emperors, the nobles, the ruling class of the Mughal Empire had to deal with this political reality. They were a minority ruling over a majority, and they generally wanted to avoid policies that would anger or upset the Hindu majority. That's the last thing they wanted, was for the Hindus to turn against them. This political desire by the ruling class ran counter to the religious desire of the religious class. So you have the religious establishment, the ulama, the scholars, the Islamic scholars, I should say, of the Mughal Empire. They wanted to have the jizya. They also wanted to exclude Hindus from any major power or any major authority within the empire. Whereas the political establishment, the sultan, the emperor, and the nobles that ruled under him, they wanted to include the Hindus. They needed to make concessions with the Hindus because they needed to use the Hindus for their military and for various other political purposes. As we have seen throughout this series on the Mughal Empire, there were thousands of Hindus incorporated into the Mughal military. The imperial military had alliances and agreements and vassals with various Hindu groups, various Hindu kingdoms. Now, there's no way for the Mughals, for the Muslims of India, to incorporate the Hindus militarily into their society without giving them something tangible. They could not ask their Hindu soldiers and warriors to fight for them, risk their lives without giving them something tangible, such as honors, titles, or something else. They had to offer something that would encourage the Hindu soldiers to fight for them. This was the political reality for the Mughal Empire. And this back and forth between the ulama and the ruling class, the religious class and the political class, this is prevalent throughout much of Muslim society. We don't have it as much today because the Muslim world has gotten a lot more secular than it was in the past. But there has always been a tug of war, so to speak, throughout much of Muslim history between the people who are running the country and the ulama, the ones who control, I won't say control religion, but the ones who interpret Islam in that region. You don't have it so much these days, perhaps maybe in Pakistan may have it to a certain extent, a tension between the religious class and the political class. But in other places, other Muslim countries, you don't really have that, either because Islam plays a much more diminished role in society, or what is more likely is that the ruling class adopts the same overarching Islamic identity as the ulama class. By that, an example of that would be, for instance, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia definitely has a ruling class, of course, the Saudi family, but it also has a religious class. It has its own ulama. However, the ulama and the ruling class are so integrated within Saudi society that this back and forth wouldn't really exist. And that just goes about the history of the formation of Saudi Arabia with the alliance between Ibn Saud and the descendants of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, and so forth and so on. So you don't really have that in Saudi Arabia, but in other Muslim countries, you may have this, but it's not as deep as it used to be. So back to our story regarding the Mughals and the jizya. So Muslim rulers in India, they have always tried to maintain good relations with their Hindu subjects. They had to. I'm not saying they were perfect at it. There were definitely some atrocities, so don't get that confused. But for the most part, the Muslim rulers who ruled over India, and they ruled over India before the Mughals came around, the Muslim kingdoms and sultanates that ruled over India tried to maintain good relations and a good relationship with their Hindu subjects. They had to, because they were in the minority. Now, this was especially true after the Delhi Sultanate began to fracture. Now, the Delhi Sultanate, of course, was the empire, sultanate, so to speak, that preceded Babur's invasion of India. But as we mentioned in the previous season, season 8, I believe, Timur the Lame, Tamerlane, invaded India, and he's particularly, specifically targeted Delhi. And after his attack on Delhi, remember he took many people as captives back to Samarkand, he devastated Delhi. That's when the Delhi Sultanate began to fracture after Timur's invasion. And from that point on, the Delhi Sultanate became many smaller kingdoms. Now, the smaller kingdoms, being nowhere near that powerful, they had to ally with local Hindu kingdoms in order to survive. So this led to closer relations between the Muslim rulers of these various kingdoms and sultanates within India, before the Mughals came, that is, and the Hindu nobility occupying the same area, the same regions. And the Hindu nobles that worked with the Muslim rulers, that allied with the Muslim rulers, they eventually gained prominence under that Muslim authority. So Akbar abolished the jizya in 1564. So from 1564 up until the reimposition of the jizya by Aurangzeb in 1679, that's over 100 years, there was no jizya in the Mughal Empire. Now, as we know, Akbar was not the most devout Muslim. There's some question if he even was Muslim. But Akbar's abolishment of the jizya in 1564 contributed to much closer relations between the Hindus and the Muslim ruling class. And just like with the Delhi Sultanate, those Hindus that served the Mughal Empire gained prominence within the empire. They gained class, they gained rank, they gained wealth, they gained titles, nobility, so forth and so on, particularly under Akbar, who married into many of these Hindu families. Now, of course, the ulama did not like what Akbar was doing. There was a lot of opposition from the ulama regarding Akbar abolishing the jizya and the close relations he forged with the Hindus and with his practice of marrying Hindus and allowing them into high positions within the empire. There was some pushback from the ulama, the religious class of Mughal society. However, Akbar's advisor, Abu Fadl, he justified abolishing the jizya for political, ideological, and economic reasons. We mentioned Abu Fadl earlier in this season, so hopefully you remember him. But just like Akbar, Abu Fadl was kind of shaky with his Islam also. Nonetheless, Abu Fadl's reasoning that he gave for abolishing the jizya was that Akbar had fostered goodwill and unity amongst the different people of the empire. The Muslims and the Hindus, according to Abu Fadl, got along just great under Akbar, so there is no reason for the jizya. Abu Fadl also argued that Akbar had more than enough treasure. He had more than enough money that negated the need for jizya. There was no financial benefit for the empire to impose jizya on the Hindus. Abu Fadl also believed that imposing the jizya would create divisions in the people and cause political unrest. Another reason he gave for abolishing the jizya, speaking about Abu Fadl now, another reason he gave for abolishing the jizya during Akbar's time was that the Hindus of the Mughal Empire were just as loyal to the state as the Muslims. Therefore, taxing them separately from the Muslims was unjust and politically unwise. In other words, politically impossible or unsavory. And as we know, Akbar promoted an ideology that all faiths were equal, that there was no superiority or inferiority between the different faiths. They were all paths leading to the same goal. That was the ideology that Akbar and Abu Fadl, for that matter, promoted. Now, that is not a traditional Islamic view, but that's what they put forward. Now, after Akbar died, interestingly, the Mughal Empire seemed to steadily become more Islamic. So Akbar's successor was his son, Jahangir. And Jahangir was not by any means a strict Muslim, not in any way whatsoever. Nonetheless, he was nowhere near as unorthodox and as heretical as his father was. His father literally created his own religion. So Jahangir was nowhere near that off the beaten path. So Jahangir was much more closer to what we would consider a standard traditional Muslim. Shah Jahan was even more religious than Jahangir, especially as he got older. As we mentioned in the previous episodes where Aurangzeb put his father under house arrest, we mentioned how Shah Jahan began to devote himself to studying the Quran when he was under house arrest. So we have Akbar, who was practically, maybe not even Muslim at all, Jahangir, who was probably a nominal Muslim, Shah Jahan, who was maybe a little bit more devout, but got more devout as he got older, and Aurangzeb, who was devout from the very beginning. He was seemingly a strict Muslim from the very beginning. And Aurangzeb was the most religious of all, at least outwardly religious, of course. As Muslims, we don't know what goes on in somebody's hearts. We're talking about his outwardly appearance of religiousness and piety. All right, moving on. Now, in the early 1600s, there was a conflict between traditional and liberal interpretations of Islam within Mughal India. There were two concepts. There was something called Wahdatul Wujud and something else called Wahdatul Shuhud. Wahdatul Wujud means unity of being. This idea states that all creation is united and connected to Allah. Therefore, all material things are distractions from strengthening this connection with Allah. And therefore, Muslims are to let go of the material world, and that includes politics. The other concept, Wahdatul Shuhud, means unity of vision. This is the idea that the creation is separate from Allah, and that any connection that we have to Allah is only in our minds and it is not reality. We do not have any real, true connection, physical connection especially, but not even spiritual connection to Allah. The supporters of this ideology believe that the other ideology, Wahdatul Wujud, leads to pantheism, which is what Akbar believed. Because pantheism is the idea that the universe and God are one and therefore accepts all deities. And once again, just like Akbar purported, all paths lead to the same destination. That is counter to Wahdatul Shuhud. Wahdatul Shuhud is the traditional view in Islam that you have Allah and then you have the creation. Allah is the creator and everything else is the creation. And we are not connected to Allah in that way. And any connection we believe we have is simply in our minds. You might not understand why this would be considered unorthodox, why this Wahdatul Wujud, that all creation is united and connected to Allah, you may not understand why this would not be accepted in traditional Islam. I'll try to explain as simply as I can. We often hear with non-Muslims in the West, particularly, I'm speaking of the United States where I live, you often hear non-Muslims, especially Christians, say things such as, God spoke to me. God put this in my heart. God said this to me. It is very rare for a Muslim to say something like that. You will very rarely hear a Muslim saying something like that because that is borderline, that is getting very close to shirk. That is stating that you are receiving revelation. For any Muslim to say that, is stating that they are receiving revelation from Allah. And only the prophets receive revelation, and Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the last prophet. So that's the danger of it. So I understand that from a Western perspective, because we hear all sorts of crazy things here in the United States, but I'm trying to help you understand that this Wahdatul Wujud would be very unorthodox in most Muslim communities. During the reign of Emperor Jahangir, there was an Islamic scholar in India named Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi. Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi promoted the traditional view, Wahdatul Shuhud, and he pushed back on these liberal teachings that were being spread in India at this time. These liberal ideologies such as Wahdatul Wujud, stating that creation is united and connected to Allah. He was pushing back against these things. Sheikh Ahmed's influence was very strong, and he helped to push the nobility, the ruling class of the Mughal Empire, closer to the orthodox, closer to the traditional way of thinking about Islam. Now, there is some speculation that the nobility went along with what Sheikh Ahmed said because they recognized Wahdatul Wujud, or these liberal ideologies, these liberal Islamic ideologies, as being a danger, as being a threat to their power. The speculation is that if Akbar's pantheistic ideas, if this Wahdatul Wujud, if this unity of creation, if this was to really take hold within India, then this would allow the Hindus to gain higher status within the empire. Now, I don't necessarily think that that's the reason why the nobility accepted the traditional view of Islam or started gravitating towards the traditional view of Islam. I think that you're just most likely convinced by Sheikh Ahmed's preaching and their internal understanding of Islam went along with that. Of course, not only did the nobility agree with Sheikh Ahmed's preaching, but also the ulama accepted Sheikh Ahmed's teachings and they opposed this Wahdatul Wujud, or many of them did. They opposed Wahdatul Wujud, and they were definitely opposed to Akbar's pantheistic policies during his reign. One person who did not like what Sheikh Ahmed was teaching was Emperor Jahangir. He was not a fan of Ahmed Sirhindi at all. I'm going to read you a quote from Jahangir's memoirs, Jahangirnama, where he describes his opinion of Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi. Also during these days, it was reported that a charlatan in Sirhind named Sheikh Ahmed had spread a net of deceit and deception in which he had trapped many unspiritual worshippers of externality. He had also sent into every city and region those of his devotees, whom he called khalifas, who were best versed in setting up shops in which mysticism could be peddled and people hoodwinked. One of the pieces of nonsense he wrote for his disciples and believers was a book called Maktubat, a miscellaneous drivel in which he had penned the basis of his claptrap that would lead to infidelity and apostasy. One thing he had written in his Maktubat was the following. During my progress, I chanced upon the stage of dual lights. I saw it was an extremely lofty and pleasant stage. I passed beyond it and reached the stage of the Faruq. From the stage of the Faruq, I crossed over to the stage of the Siddiq. Having written a description worthy of each, I became at one with the stage of Mahbubiyat. It was seen as a stage of extremely brilliant light and color. I found myself reflected in the lights and colors, that is, God forgive me, I passed beyond the stage of the caliphs and ascended to the highest level. He made other impudent claims it would take too long to write, and it would be too impolite to do so. I therefore ordered him brought to court. He paid homage as ordered, but he couldn't give a reasonable answer to anything asked him. He appeared, in addition to his lack of wisdom and knowledge, to be extremely conceited and self-satisfied. I saw that the only thing to do with him was to let him spend a few days in prison so that the frenzy in his mind would settle down, as well as the uproar among the common folk. I turned him over to Ani Rai Singh Dalin to imprison in the fortress at Gwalior. Jahangir, the Jahangirnama. So from this excerpt, we see a couple of things. First, that Jahangir had no love for Sheikh Ahmed. And we also see that perhaps Sheikh Ahmed had some Sufi leanings himself. Now, all Sufism is not necessarily as far-fetched as Wahdatul Wujud, so let's keep that in mind. Sufism is a very broad term. I'm not going to get too deep into that, but I'm just letting you know, just because someone is Sufi does not mean they believe in Wahdatul Wujud or the oneness of creation, the connection of creation with Allah. That's, you know, a bit much to say. Also understand that Jahangir was perhaps only nominally Muslim. We can't see into his heart. We don't know how he truly believed. I'm not saying he didn't believe, but he was not, at least outwardly, as pious as the two emperors that came after him, Shah Jahan and Aurangzeb. Considering that he was much more secular, in my opinion, I would say Jahangir was probably much more secular, not as head in the clouds as Akbar, but not as strict and rigid as Aurangzeb, and perhaps not as outwardly religious as Shah Jahan. I would say more secular. He was a very secular Muslim in many respects. And in my understanding and from what I got after studying his history, and Allah knows best. So I can understand why he would have a negative perception of Sheikh Ahmed, especially when Sheikh Ahmed was starting to cause some disruption within the empire. But another thing to understand is that Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi was not very pro-Shiite. Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi spoke unfavorably of the Shiites and Jahangir's wife, Nur Jahan. She was a Shiite. Remember, her father came over from Persia. So that could be another reason why Jahangir did not like Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi. The point of this story about Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi was to try to illustrate how the nobility, the noble class, the ruling class of the Mughal Empire was slowly becoming more traditional, becoming more conservative. And we mentioned how Sheikh Ahmed convinced many nobles to accept this more conservative, traditional view of Islam. And what I will say is probably the more true view of Islam, but that's neither here nor there. But still, he was instrumental in bringing more of the nobility to this more traditional view. And as we can see, and as mentioned earlier, we can see how Akbar's successors seem to become exceedingly more religious as the years passed. Jahangir and Shah Jahan, they especially had to balance between pleasing the ulama class and not upsetting the Hindus. Jahangir, for the most part, he did not change his father's policies towards the Hindus. Again, he was not as unorthodox as Akbar, but Jahangir maintained much of the same policies towards the Hindus that his father Akbar had. Shah Jahan, who was more religious than Jahangir, he tried to assert Islam's primacy. Even though he wasn't the most outwardly devout Muslim, nowhere near as Aurangzeb was, he still was more of a practicing Muslim in my readings of his life. And again, especially as he got older. But he didn't want to alienate the Hindus too much either. However, we also know that he destroyed many Hindu temples, but he did not impose the jizya. So seemingly he was trying to do this balancing act as well, trying to appease the ulama, but trying not to upset the Hindus too much. After Shah Jahan, however, the concept of the Mughal Empire being an Islamic empire began to grow in prominence. And this idea that the Mughal Empire was an Islamic empire especially grew strong when it appeared that Dada Shikoh, Aurangzeb's brother, had a chance of taking the throne. The ulama, the scholarly class, they were concerned that if Dada Shikoh became the emperor, they were going to return to the ways of Akbar. And that is what the scholars were afraid of. The ulama were concerned about having another emperor on the throne similar to Akbar. And these concerns, this fear that the empire would go back to the ways of Emperor Akbar, this helped to shape the way Islam was practiced and how Islam formed within the Mughal Empire during this time. These religious tensions, this concern of Dada Shikoh bringing the empire back to the ways of Akbar, was what helped propel Aurangzeb to eventually impose the jizya. Now, of course, it wasn't a straight line from fear of Dada Shikoh to the jizya. There was a lot more in between there, but this is the impetus. This fear of Dada Shikoh is what caused the ulama to become more conservative, more traditional, and also push more of a traditional view of Islam in the empire, and also encourage and pressure Aurangzeb to become more strict in his practice and imposition of Islam. People use the word cleric, and I can't stand that word because it's not really a cleric, but this is the scholarly class of Muslims, those Muslims who go to school and devote their lives to studying Islam and then teaching what they study to others and helping guide the lay Muslim, which is most of us, to better understand Islam and get closer to Allah. Ulama is plural for alim. Alim comes from the word alama, which means to know. The ulama are those Muslims, men and women, who have devoted their lives to studying Islam and teaching Islam. They also are often involved with giving advice to rulers. The ulama play an important part in Islam. In the Mughal Empire, the ulama in particular controlled education and schooling. This is the way it is in many Muslim societies, actually. The ulama often control education in almost any Muslim society. At least traditional Muslim society, not now when you have nation states running everything. But in traditional Islamic societies, the ulama, the scholars, often controlled education and schooling in that region. The Mughal Empire was no different. But this control of education gave the ulama considerable influence among the people because they taught people from childhood. If you have a scholar who taught you from childhood, taught you how to read Arabic, taught you how to read the Quran, taught you how to pray, answer all your questions, of course, you're going to have a very good relationship to him. Very often, you can find like one scholar, one alim, who may be very influential in a certain region. Or he may write books that become very popular. Or he may be a great speaker and a teacher or a preacher, and his lectures are very inspiring to people. The ulama had considerable influence, but they were also advisors to the rulers. So you have the ulama who had a connection, a direct connection to the common folks, because once again, they taught people from childhood all the way through adulthood. but they were also advisors to the ruler. So this is a very powerful position to have. The ulama wanted to promote the Islamic nature of the state, and they pressured the ruling class, the nobles, the sultans and all, they pressured them to do the same thing, to promote the Islamic nature of the state. As I mentioned before, the last thing they wanted was to return to the time of Akbar. I can't stress this enough, how fearful they were of having another emperor like Akbar who might not have even been Muslim. That was a major concern for the ulama at that time. To try to maybe illustrate this a little bit better, imagine how many problems there would be in the United States if we had an avowed communist become the president. Not a socialist, no, not a Bernie Sanders socialist. I mean an avowed communist, someone who wanted to put Marx and Stalin right there next to George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Can you imagine the uproar in the United States? Even if that communist president said he's not going to change the Constitution, I'm going to rule by the Constitution, I'm going to govern by the Constitution, even if he said all that, there would be such an uproar in this country. That might lead to civil war if nothing else did. I hope that helps you understand how concerned the ulama were of having an emperor who was not Muslim, especially when that emperor has much more power, much more complete authority than the president of the United States has. The president of the United States has checks and balances, right? The emperor could do whatever he wanted practically. The only thing he had to be worried about was if his actions would lead to rebellion. That's the major thing he had to be concerned about. Other than that, these Mughal emperors could do whatever they wanted. So it was a very important, it's a major concern for the ulama to make sure that the emperor of the Mughal Empire promoted Islam. These scholars, the ulama, they expected the Mughal rulers to promote Islam and eventually to enforce the traditional practices of Islam, which included the payment of jizya. Now, when Aurangzeb became the emperor, he initially avoided overtly proclaiming the supremacy of Islam. He had to form alliances with the Rajputs. He had to incorporate the Hindus into his government structure and into his military. So he couldn't do that and then come out saying that my religion is better than yours. He couldn't say that outwardly like that, even if he obviously believed it. Nonetheless, his accession, his rise to power was very much welcomed by the ulama, by the Islamic scholarly class of the Mughal Empire. And rightfully so, because when Aurangzeb did become the emperor, even though he didn't outwardly claim the supremacy of Islam at first, he did introduce a more Islamic nature to the government. He revived these orders that had prohibited building new Hindu temples. He began to suppress innovations. By innovations, I don't mean scientific innovations. That's not what I'm talking about. Innovation or bid'ah in Islam, speaking to you if you are not familiar with these terms, innovations in Islam, the Arabic word is bid'ah, is a new practice in Islam, something that was not practiced traditionally by Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, something within the religion. So I'm talking about you invent a new telephone or a new piece of machinery, that's not religion, that's just life. But if you invent a new way of praying to Allah, that could be innovation, that might be bid'ah. Those are the sort of things that he was trying to suppress. Another thing about Aurangzeb is that, as we mentioned, when he was going through a fratricidal civil war, he justified his war against his brothers, especially Dada Shikoh, and the imprisonment of his father. He justified them by using Islam as the reason. He justified these actions by saying that he was trying to preserve Islam in India. Now, even though Aurangzeb was definitely more religious, even though he was more sensitive to the requests and the desires and the pressure from the ulama class, he did not allow the ulama to set government policy. Aurangzeb's more orthodox views on Islam strengthened the influence of the orthodox traditional Islamic elements within the empire. And this, of course, impacted state policies. So Aurangzeb was more religious. Therefore, the ulama, they felt emboldened with their own orthodox religiosity, and they were more comfortable with suggesting more Islamic, more religious, more orthodox practices or policies within the religion or within the empire, and Aurangzeb, being more religious himself, was more receptive to these suggestions. So now let's try to understand why Aurangzeb decided to bring back the jizya. Muslim historians attribute this decision due to pressure from the ulama, and that's definitely partially true. These ulama encouraged Aurangzeb to impose the jizya because they said it was compulsory according to the Sharia, according to Islamic law. They knew, they could see that Aurangzeb was more religious, they was more pious than the previous Mughal rulers, and they saw this as their chance to bring about a more religious society in India. One example of how Aurangzeb portrayed his religious feelings, his religious piety, was that he tried to limit taxation. He tried to abolish taxes that were not based on Sharia. So that's the view from the Muslim historians, that Aurangzeb was pressured by the ulama. Europeans who were either traveling in India at this time and observed what was going on, they suggested a different reason for the jizya. They believed that Aurangzeb had to replenish his treasury and that he wanted to convince poorer Hindus to convert to Islam. We're going to discuss these two ideas right now. Let's take the second one first. This idea that Aurangzeb imposed the jizya to encourage or push non-Muslims into Islam is really not supported by historical evidence. India had been ruled by Muslims for centuries, long before the Mughal Empire came around. They had been ruled before the Mughals by the Delhi Sultanate. And during all this period of time, there have been Hindus in India this whole time. I'm not exactly sure why more Hindus did not convert to Islam. For instance, in West Africa, when Islam came there, almost the entire society was Muslim within a couple hundred years. Same thing with Bosnia. Other parts of the Muslim world, when Islam came, within a few centuries, everybody who was not Muslim was Muslim. Why didn't that really happen in India? I've thought about it. I don't really know why. I haven't really done a lot of study on it. But perhaps it may simply be due to the large number of people in India. These other places I mentioned, West Africa, Bosnia, these places are fairly sparsely populated compared to India, which today is the second largest country in the world, maybe even the largest by now, who knows? There's a lot of people in India, right? You got a lot of people in India. And so even if you have thousands upon thousands of people accepting Islam, that may only make a dent in the overall population because there are just so many people. Another reason why Islam may not have spread as thoroughly in India as in other parts of the world might be just simply because of the sheer size of India. India, the Indian subcontinent we're talking about from Pakistan to Bangladesh, is humongous. It is tremendously large. That's a lot of land to carry. Now, West Africa is big too, yes, but it's also sparsely populated. Bosnia is not that big in comparison. So perhaps that might have contributed to the slower growth of Islam in India. Or perhaps there was a lack of dawah effort from the Indian Muslim states. Now, I'm not aware of any devoted effort from the Mughal emperors to preach Islam to the non-Muslims. Now, we have those examples of the Sikh rebels who were captured and they were given the offer of accepting Islam, and when they didn't, they were executed. That's not the same thing. We're talking about trained da'is, or trained missionaries in English. Trained Muslim missionaries and da'is going out amongst the people sponsored by the government to teach Islam specifically to non-Muslims. I don't know if the Mughal Empire had that. Maybe they did. I haven't caught it yet in my reading. Certainly Akbar would not have had any sort of organization, government-funded organization, that was specifically going out trying to convert Hindus to Islam. I seriously doubt Akbar would have supported something like that. Government funded, that is. Also, I don't really think Jahangir would have done it either. Shah Jahan, maybe. Aurangzeb, almost certainly, but I'm not aware that he did. So that's my question. I know for certain that the Ottoman Empire definitely sent da'is, missionaries, into Bosnia to spread Islam. But I'm not aware of a similar thing happening in the Mughal Empire, and Allah knows best. It is not likely that Aurangzeb expected the jizya to bring mass conversions. There's no evidence showing any sort of significant conversions from Hindus to Islam during his reign. So there's no evidence basically stating that Aurangzeb was just trying to get poor Hindus to accept Islam. There's no proof of that. Now, the suggestion that Aurangzeb had to replenish his treasury, well, there may have been some merit with that. Aurangzeb needed funds from the north and from Bengal to finance his 25-year war in the Deccan. Since he was not in the north to manage the affairs of the government, he had to rely on his sons and trusted nobles to send him the wealth that he needed. Listen to this quote discussing Aurangzeb's finances regarding the war. 25 long years of tireless effort had passed since his arrival in the Deccan, and he had absolutely nothing to show for it. The territories he claimed to have conquered were left behind in ruins, an easy prey for bandits and brigands of all kinds, Marathas as well as former soldiers of the extinct Deccan Sultanates. His own great Mughal empire lay in ruins, its coffers depleted in an unwinnable war, its officers utterly incompetent and corrupt, and its population dirt poor and discontent. Rebellion was looming everywhere. His own resolve and moral authority still held the empire together, but he realized fully well that it was only a matter of time before it would fall apart like a house of cards. Dirk Collier, The Mughals and Their India. So according to this author, the empire's expenses was exceeding its income, and that most likely was true. These were very costly wars that Aurangzeb was running down in the Deccan, and he was not really getting much territorial gain for them. He already had the Deccan. He already controlled it. So he was chasing the Marathas through the hills, but he was not able to really get any benefit for all this warfare that he was funding. There is other evidence that seems to show that the Mughal treasury was doing very well. When Aurangzeb's son and his successor occupied Agra, listen to this quote about what he found. The imperial reserves at Agra proved to be little depleted by the Deccan Wars. Bahadur Shah's officers found coined and uncoined gold and silver totaling 240 million rupees, considerably greater than Akbar's reserves at his death. John F. Richards, The Mughal Empire. There's also the idea that I alluded to in the previous episode and also earlier in this episode that the jizya was justified because Aurangzeb abolished other taxes. We mentioned that Aurangzeb abolished taxes that he believed were against the Sharia, and there is some theory that the jizya was supposed to make up for this lost revenue. There may be some support for this. There's not much support for it, not directly at least. I'll try to explain what I mean. Now, first of all, it is virtually impossible to determine how much revenue the jizya actually brought into the empire. We don't have any way of figuring out definitively how much money the jizya brought into the Mughal Empire's coffers during the time of Aurangzeb's reign. However, the estimates say that the jizya may have brought in about 1 to 4% of the total Mughal Empire's revenue during this period. Now, it may seem that the jizya was just a blanket tax on anyone who was a Muslim, but that is not necessarily true. There were many exemptions from the jizya. For instance, if someone experienced crop failures, they did not have to pay the jizya. Poor non-Muslims living within the Mughal Empire did not have to pay the jizya. Now, Christian traders, generally European traders, the Europeans, they did have to pay an additional 10% tax instead of the jizya when they were importing goods into India, into Mughal territory. So European traders who were by and large Christian, they didn't have to pay the jizya per se because they were not residents of the Mughal Empire, but they were bringing goods into the Mughal Empire's territory, mostly coming from Europe and other places. They had to pay an extra 10% duty on top of that instead of the jizya. So the jizya tax that was collected, it didn't go into paying the empire's expenses or into Aurangzeb's pockets. The jizya was separated into a specific treasury bucket, so to speak, and it was used primarily for charity. So let's dispel this idea, or at least minimize the importance of this idea that Aurangzeb had to impose the jizya to pay for his wars or to pay for his expenses. That's not the case at all. The jizya was not used for warfare or for state expenses. The jizya was mostly used for charity and to pay for government stipends. We're going to talk about those stipends a little bit more in just a moment. Now, of course, using the jizya to pay for charity on behalf of the government and the government stipends that they had to pay to so many people, this did relieve pressure on the government's treasury to pay for these things, and so it freed up funds that could be used for warfare and for the state's expenses. But just want to let you know that the jizya was not directly applied to state expenses, except for the stipends. That is a bit of a state expense. So financial motives were not the main reason for Aurangzeb to reintroduce the jizya. The primary reasons were very complex. They were political, ideological, and social. One of the social reasons were the stipends that we just mentioned. Many people within Mughal society received government stipends for various reasons. These included military officials, soldiers, Islamic scholars. Yes, the ulama received government stipends. Well, many of them, not all of them. The ulama received government stipends, artists, poets, widows, orphans, and many other people, defeated opponents. There's so many reasons why the Mughals had to give out stipends for various different reasons. The jizya was used to pay for that. Now, this has actually been a part of Islam's legacy for centuries. Umar ibn Khattab, the second caliph of Islam, was the first to establish a stipend policy when he was the caliph. But if left unchecked, the stipends could grow to unwieldy amounts. If you're just handing out stipends to a bunch of people for any reason, your successor is going to have themselves a huge obligation. This is a similar thing that happened during the reign of Umar ibn Khattab. Well, not really him, but after he died and he was succeeded by Uthman, one of the reasons for the discontent against Uthman ibn Affan radiallahu anhu was the stipend policy. The stipend policy had grown during the time of Umar ibn Khattab and continued to grow during the time of Uthman ibn Affan, but the expansion of the Islamic Khilafat, of the Islamic Caliphate, was slowing down. They had already overrun much of the Byzantine territory and much of the Persian territory, and now they're getting into the area of Central Asia and Afghanistan, and it was getting a little bit more difficult to expand into these areas. They were starting to experience more resistance. Also in North Africa, the Berbers gave them a lot of resistance out there also. And so with the expansion starting to slow down, there was less money coming in. But the stipends were still there. The promises of these stipends were still there, and it was getting more difficult to expand the stipends and to manage it. And that contributed to the animosity of some sectors within the Khilafat at that time against Uthman ibn Affan. Well, the medieval sultans of the Mughal Empire experienced the same thing. Akbar, during his reign, to his credit, he did make some changes to try to alleviate the issue of stipends that had been imposed by him and also by his father and grandfather, Humayun and Babur. When Aurangzeb first became the emperor, he considered bringing back the jizya, but he postponed it for political reasons, mostly to maintain and strengthen the alliance he had with the Rajputs, who a portion of them had rebelled against him. Also, because he was at that point in time, early in his reign, he was hoping that he could probably meet the Marathas halfway, maybe get some sort of agreement with the Marathas. However, the Maratha threat continued to grow, as we already know. The Shivaji and those guys, they kept on breaking their promises with the Mughals and kept on raiding Mughal territory. And eventually Aurangzeb decided that it was time to just conquer the entire Deccan. Part of the reason for him conquering the Bijapur and Golconda Sultanates was because they kept allying with the Marathas. They allowed the Marathas to exist. They allied with the Marathas. They fought against them too, but they allied with the Marathas and gave the Marathas that lifeline that they needed. Aurangzeb thought that if he conquered these two Muslim sultanates who kept allying with the Marathas, causing all this trouble, it would make it easier for him to deal with the Marathas. Now, maybe it did make it easier, but we know what happened with that anyway. It was at this point that Aurangzeb decided to reinstate the jizya. Let's look at the timeline. 1676, Aurangzeb begins full expansion into the Deccan, and in 1679, that's when he imposes the jizya on the non-Muslims living in the Mughal Empire. Part of his reason for doing this was to rally Muslims behind him, but also to reinforce a more strict Islamic state, but also perhaps as a way to punish the Marathas. Perhaps that was part of it also. It's debatable whether this worked or not because the Deccan was already full of political tension at this time. There was spillover from Aurangzeb's war with the Rator Rajputs that was taking place just north of the Deccan. There was also growing unemployment among the ulama, especially within the Deccan. And there are some historians who believe that this jizya made this political situation even worse in the Deccan. Now, to counter the unemployment of the ulama, Aurangzeb actually hired many Islamic scholars, many alim or ulama within the Deccan to collect and distribute the jizya. This gave these scholars work, allowed them to earn some money. However, there are reports, a few reports, of some of these scholars abusing this position. Some of them used it as an opportunity to humiliate the Hindus. Some of them used it to extort money, extra money from the Hindus. Of course, the influential Hindus living within the Deccan, they were very upset about the jizya, especially those living in urban areas such as merchants and bankers, and led to some protests and also led to some Hindus shutting down their business and moving elsewhere. And eventually the jizya became like a rallying cry, a focal point for all of the different grievances that the non-Muslims already had against the empire. The jizya became a focal point for all of that. Now, it's hard to say why Aurangzeb's jizya experiment failed. Definitely, the Hindus who had grown accustomed to the policies of Akbar and Jahangir and Shah Jahan, definitely they were shocked and they were definitely insulted by it. But I don't necessarily think that the jizya in and of itself helped to accelerate the Mughal Empire's decline. In my opinion, it was already in decline. It had been perhaps covered up during the time of Aurangzeb's early reign and maybe during his father's reign. But really, the fratricidal wars, and especially Aurangzeb's campaign in the Deccan, that to me was one of the things that accelerated the decline of the Mughal Empire. Not necessarily the jizya in and of itself. That may have contributed to it. Allah knows best. But I really do think Aurangzeb's war in the Deccan, him being in the Deccan and not being in the capital and managing the empire's wars and not managing the empire in and of itself, I think that contributed more to the decline of the Mughal Empire than the jizya itself. So we're going to wrap this up here. Hopefully we can see that Aurangzeb did not reinstate the jizya out of some sort of hatred or bigotry towards the Hindus. Throughout his reign, he continued to ally with the Rajputs and other Hindu ruling classes. The jizya was a religious and political decision. It was not an anti-Hindu decision. We can boil Aurangzeb's reasons for imposing the jizya down to 3 points. Number one, he was a devout Muslim, and he believed the jizya was a legitimate part of Islam. Number two, he wanted to maintain the support of the ulama, the religious scholarly class of India. And number three, he needed additional revenue to support the growing welfare class, the stipend recipients within the Mughal Empire. Those, to me, are the three reasons why he decided to impose the jizya, and Allah knows best. So we'll stop it there. In the next episode, inshallah, we will begin the discussion of the reign of Bahadur Shah, and we'll talk about yet another devastating fratricidal civil war. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the Podbean app and you'll get access to all of our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. Our premium content includes a series on the life of Salahuddin, an ongoing series about the Umayyad dynasty, and one I think you'll really enjoy, our latest series on the Soviet-Afghan War. Altogether, that's well over 50 premium episodes. Before we go, I want to thank Brother Zulfikar Seroj for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Stay tuned for a short clip from our series on the Soviet-Afghan War. And until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Nur Taraki was also an idealistic communist. He really believed in the communist cause. He was very adamant about pushing communist policies forward and killing, squashing, destroying, wiping out any sort of dissent against that. He pursued this land redistribution program that really angered rural Afghans. And once again, I gotta remind you, most Afghans lived in the rural areas. That was an area that every single government had trouble controlling. Nur Taraki executed and imprisoned thousands of Afghans who were bold enough to try to resist his reforms. Now, I want to tell you about this quickly, about this land redistribution thing. This seems to be a recurring theme in a lot of Muslim countries as they try to modernize their lands. I've seen this both in the Ottoman Empire when the Young Turks took over. They tried a land redistribution program many parts of the Islamic world, Afghanistan, obviously, but also Anatolia, Bosnia, as well as Iran. We discussed this as well in the 1979 revolution of Iran in our series from several years ago. Many parts of the Muslim world were still under a feudal system. We're talking about being under a feudal system in the 1970s, 1960s. And yet it was time to change. The feudal system was inefficient and holding the nation as a whole back. And this is not necessarily a communist thing. Those three nations that I mentioned, Afghanistan, Iran, as well as the Ottoman Empire, all three of them tried to redistribute land. Basically, the feudal system means that large plots of land were held by one family or one man or one powerful, wealthy landlord, and a bunch of peasants worked the land on behalf of that landlord. Much of the Muslim world, well, at least these three countries, let me stop saying much of the Muslim world. These three countries definitely were doing that. These three states, Afghanistan, Iran, Ottoman Empire, they were definitely doing that. And so when these new westernized governments came forward, they tried to break that pattern. And each and every single time they did that, it led to revolution, it led to anger. It never works, mostly because they did it at the tip of a sword or at the barrel of a gun. They forced the people to do these sort of things, and they didn't slowly bring it in. They didn't try, I don't know, all of them tried a very ham-fisted way of ramming this new system down these landlords' throats, and it never worked out. They tried to take, basically, they were taking land away from the landlords, splitting up into several different pieces, and then giving it to the peasants and saying, here you go, work the land. This never worked as well as they expected it to. It always failed. Part of the problem was, of course, the landlords resisted it. And some of these landlords were powerful. Some of them had a lot of money and could put together their own militaries if they wanted to. It broke a centuries-old system that the people were comfortable with. And the peasants who now gained this new land, they often wound up back in servitude because they didn't have the skills, they didn't have the money to buy the proper machinery and the proper tools to cultivate their land. They wound up usually selling their land back to the landlords. Or the children, as time is modernized, we're talking about the 1970s now, as times modernized, the peasants' children didn't want to work the land. They moved to the big cities. That's what happened a lot in Iran. And so this system always failed when these nations tried to force the landlords in the rural areas to accept this redistribution program. It always failed. I'm not saying it's not the right thing to do. I'm not saying it is the right thing to do either, but the way that they did it was not the right way of doing it. Allah knows best what is the right way to do it, or even if it should be done. I mean, I can go into a few stories about how this was actually done during the time of the righteous caliphs. It's not really, let me back this up. There's a story, I know I'm going off track, but I'll come back, inshallah. I'll come back to the Soviet Union. There's a story where during the time of Omar ibn Khattab, the Muslims had conquered huge parts of land in, once again, Persia. They conquered a whole bunch of Persia, and the Muslims, many of them who were Sahaba, had conquered these lands or had led militaries into conquering these new lands. And so they considered, like, this is now my land. I fought for this land. I earned it with my sword and my blood. This is now my land. But Omar ibn Khattab, he wanted that land to be used to resettle Muslims in these areas to balance out the Muslim population in these areas, to bring more Arabs and more Muslims into these areas to establish the Muslim authority or the Islamic authority in these new areas that they had recently conquered. There's one story where Bilal ibn Rabah, yes, the famous Muadhin of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, he resisted this. He said, I'm not going to give up my land that I conquered with my sword. But Bilal could not manage this whole land by himself. I mean, you're talking about huge tracts of land, okay? Perhaps hundreds and hundreds of miles of square miles of land. And he didn't inherit this from his father. He conquered it at the behest of the military commander. And he conquered it at the behest of the ruler or the Khalifa. And so Omar ibn Khattab, he had to force Bilal. I might say force. He didn't hurt him anything. He just said, Bilal, you're going to listen to me. He basically told Bilal, you're going to follow orders and follow my decrees. You're going to go ahead and let me take this land and redistribute it out to other Muslims so we can populate this region with more Muslims. So that's basically what happened. That's the one example of redistribution from the Sahaba's time. But it's not the same thing. It is not the same thing as this, where these communists, and they weren't doing it for Islamic purposes anyway, they're doing it for atheistic purposes, where these communists were basically taking land from these landlords, these landowners, these feudal lords who had held it for generations, taking it and now giving it to these peasants who really didn't have the sophistication to manage them, and it turned out horribly for everyone involved.